My name's Jeff Sachs. I'm the director of ATID. On behalf of everyone that's involved in our organization, and particularly those that were involved in putting this evening together, who you'll meet presently, welcome. Thank you all for coming. I apologize on behalf of Rabbi Bravender, who was slated, of course, to be here and to give his customary summing up. He was called away and is in London today, so he won't be with us, but sends his apologies and his regards. I saw my old friend, Rabbi Alan Haber, from MMY. Alan, I don't know if you remember this. 20 years ago, I was madrich on a summer tour here in Israel, an NCSY summer tour, and as part of the program, we brought the kids to Yeshivat Har Etzion, to the Gush, where you were then, I think, studying in the Kollel. Or you were here for the year, or doing something, I don't recall. And it was in the summer, I think it was actually even during Bein HaZmanim, and we spent some time in Alon Shvut, and then we took them to see the Beit Midrash, which was, you know, basically empty because it was after Tisha B'Av. And we sat upstairs in the Ezrat Nashim, and you were there giving some kind of talk or shiur to the kids about Torah Eretz Yisrael. Do you remember this? And one of the kids, not out of chutzpah, but I think out of a genuine interest, asked a question along the lines of, what's all this about Torah Eretz Yisrael? Why is learning Torah here? We've been hearing this, we're full of this. Everybody's pushing this on us, the importance of learning Torah in Israel. What's the difference? You learn a Daf Gemara in Alon Shvut or Yerushalayim or Yavna or wherever it is, or you learn it in New York or Boca Raton or Philadelphia or Far Rockaway. What's the difference? You gave an answer, which I won't repeat here. Then I gave a different answer. Not that I disagreed with you, but I had my own take on it. Then one of the other counselors gave their own answer, and so on and so forth, until there was this harmony of voices, all addressing this topic. And it's a very rich one, and it's a very complex one. And on behalf, I think, of almost all of us here who are involved in teaching Torah in Israel, I hope you would allow me to say on your behalf, as well as my own, Ashreinu Matov Chelkeinu, that we are all involved in teaching Torah Hashem Tmima in Eretz Yisrael, for most of us largely to students that are here as visitors. We hope that they'll upgrade their status. And that's something very worthy, and it's something very noble, and it's something that we're all very, those of us that are involved with that, it's something that we are all very fortunate of. The impetus for the discussion tonight should in no way take away from the significance of that fact, the significance of what has been accomplished these 35, 40 years since American diaspora students have been coming to study Torah in Eretz Yisrael, and the accomplishments that are made every single day in the classroom, in the Beit Midrash, in the Chadar Ochel, Shabbatot around teachers' tables and communities throughout the country, in no way should diminish from those accomplishments and the zchuyot that are rightly those of the people that are entitled to those zchuyot. We were approached by two people, neither of whom, I should say for the record, was myself or Yoel Finkelman, with these opinion pieces. They don't necessarily reflect my own views. They don't necessarily reflect the views of our institution, as if institutions have views, and everyone knows exactly what that meant. And we thought it was interesting, because although they each came from their own perspective, and they were each addressing a particular field of problems, there was a point of intersection, and we'll talk about that. And we thought it was worthy to put it out, and since the printed articles, copies of which along with some of other publications are available back there on the tables. Since it did draw such attention, we thought it would be worthwhile to convene a discussion evening. Now, in order to do that, sometimes you frame things in a somewhat provocative way. I don't think that we're going to solve all of our problems tonight. I don't even think that we're going to agree on what our problems are tonight in order to solve them. But I think, Molly, we saw each other last night at parent-teacher conferences, and you pointed out very correctly that just the very gathering of mechanchim together in a room to discuss Torah ma'omdim berumo shel olam, discuss important matters, is important. And it's something that we rarely have an opportunity to do, and it's something that is very unhealthy. It's professionally unhealthy. It's unhealthy for each of us as professionals, and it's unhealthy for the profession as a whole. So if we have an opportunity to get together, to discuss an important matter, to disagree, to perhaps point a direction forward for ways that we might improve our collective work, again, Ashreinu u'matov chelkenu. I'm going to pass the microphone over to Dr. Yoel Finkelman, who fulfills his job to get us to think about things and to put things onto the agenda of Jewish educators, and he's once again done that well with this particular item. And he'll explain to you how the evening's going to work. At the end of the evening, after we have a chance for some questions from the audience, we've asked, in place of Rabbi Bravender, we've asked our friend and colleague and member of the board of Atid, Dr. David Bernstein of Pardes, to kind of give a little summation to help us understand what it is that we've heard or are about to hear. So thank you all for coming, and I look forward to an interesting discussion.
Thank you, Rabbi Sachs, and thank you to the panelists. I want to just briefly talk about what's going to happen this evening and how we've tried to organize it, and begin by saying that the interplay of economics and education is not going to go away. We've worked very hard to make sure that this evening is not an attempt to suggest that somehow educational institutions can ignore the economics. People have to make a living. People have to balance their budgets. Im ein kemach ein Torah. One does not have to be a Marxist to suggest that education and chinuch ought to work ideally harmoniously. And I think therefore the topic is extremely important. Both essays really kind of, the overlap on the Venn diagram between these two essays is the way in which chinuch and economics play themselves out. The two essays were criticized with a degree, to my mind, correctly, of being kind of focusing on negatives, focusing on criticisms, and not focusing enough on productive, positive things. And I hope we'll be able to focus this evening on positive developments, things that we can do to work to move forward. Certainly do not want to see the focus drift in the direction of personal accusations or institutional accusations. And we really hope that we'll be able to keep things focused on productive comments. And therefore we're really not going to deal with matters of hiring and firing and the exact details of this individual or that institution's practices. With that being said, this not being the forum for such a discussion, we are interested in convening a smaller working group of educators, of administrators, of interested professionals who would like to think through on a more practical level what ought to be employer-employee relations what are the minimum standards, what are the minimum legal standards, what are the minimum menschlich standards. If there are people here, or if people here know of others who are interested in being involved in such a smaller, more closed forum, a working group to try to create a document that describes both legally and from a menschlich perspective what ought Yachasei Oved Ma'avid look like, please, Emuna Diamond, who manages the Atid office in the Web Yeshiva, has a sign-up sheet available. And I also want to point out that suggesting that such a working group be put into place is not to suggest that any or all institutions are in gross violation. My employer is located here, and I should point out that I have been treated with nothing but proper professionalism. I also want to introduce the panelists tonight. Mrs. Molly Brofsky, just about to be a clinical social worker who's been teaching at MMY for many years and who is a Bogeret of the Atid Fellows. Rabbi Alex Israel, who teaches in Yeshivat Eretz HaTzvi, Rabbi Donny Goldstein, who I've been told that I can out him as the person who wrote the economic side of things, and who provides perspective both as a staff person in Midrashet Amit here, but also somebody who, as a congregational rabbi of the Kingsway Jewish Center in Brooklyn, has the perspective, some of the U.S. perspective and some of the communal perspective, and also Rabbi Yamin Goldsmith, who also provides both the Chutz La'aretz perspective and his administrative roles in schools in North America, and is the Menahel of Shalvim for Women, and of course is a Boger of the Atid Fellows. The plan is as follows. Each of the panelists will have about 10, maximum 12 minutes Frankfurt on Main time to present one angle on the issue. During the course of the presentations, cards are available here in the back on the table where Emuna is sitting. If you have questions that you would like to raise toward the end, please write them down in clear, legible handwriting. Pass them up to the front where Rabbi Sachs will have them. We have found that that is a more effective way of dealing with questions from the crowd. And then we will, after the four presentations, we will have a chance to address some of the questions to the panelists. And after that, Dr. David Bernstein from Pardes will summarize. With that, Mrs. Molly Brofsky.
Is the mic okay? Lower? Like that? Okay. Firstly, I'd like to mention that from the responses that this panel generated and the feedback that at least I received, it seems to have hit a very strong chord in the educational community. I think that's worth noting, for whatever it's worth. I believe that the articles that were the springboard for this evening address the issues clearly and cogently. What I would like to do is provide a framework for thinking about the issues and help us kind of sort them out and clarify for ourselves how to best address them. When thinking about problems, there's a theory that divides issues into what they call solvable problems and perpetual problems. Solvable problems are problems that can be resolved through either conflict resolution, direct action, strategies. I think the issues involving economics fall more or less into this category, and all sorts of suggestions have been and can be proposed about how to deal with them. So those issues I'm going to leave to those infinitely more qualified than I am, and I'm going to attempt to talk about the edutainment from a educator's pedagogical perspective. Okay, perpetual problems are problems that arise out of inevitable life circumstances with which one has to learn how to cope and how to deal, given the underlying real situation. I believe many of the issues that were raised under edutainment fall into this category. In many ways, in the one-year programs, we are working with certain givens. These include the fact that our students are coming to us from and at a certain place, and that place has been rapidly transforming in recent years. The combination of the current cultural background and technology has resulted in a series of developments. These include raised expectations of instant gratification, both in the classroom as well as in their overall experience of the year. These girls exhibit a much greater degree of dependency on their parents, which is upkept through constant access and connection to their homes. And they experience a much less degree of immersion in the overall Israel experience as a whole. This translates into a host of ramifications that were pinpointed in the article, which those of you who don't remember can go and read, which describe many of today's students as having diminished ability to analyze texts or to think critically, and feeling a greater sense of entitlement, and looking for instantaneous relief of unhappiness or discomfort, which increases pressure on teachers and on institutions. In addition, we also have them for a very short time. We have 1 year, limited by all kinds of breaks, in which we are expected to achieve nothing less than transforming their intellectual, spiritual, and religious identity. We don't have 4 years like in high school. We don't have a captive audience like in high school. We have to reach them quickly and effectively. Incidentally, it is possible that a certain type of teacher will be more or less successful within these parameters, which doesn't necessarily make them a better or worse educator. It just makes them more or less appropriate to work with this population. I'd like to note here that it's important to view our students as they are now, today, not 10 years ago. They are different than they were. I think there is a natural tendency to condemn the immaturity, self-absorption, lack of seriousness, and materialism among the youth that goes back to Roman times. Google it. Before we begin to evaluate issues, I think it's important to be aware of self and determine honestly how much our reactions are related to the fact that we are no longer teaching ourselves or the students we thought we'd be teaching, and sort that out from the real our real responses to changes in the educational climate. There are a lot of lovely young people out there, and in addition, let's not forget to keep an eye out for the positives ensuing from these inevitable changes, which again, I'm going to leave to the more creative or perhaps techno-savvy among us. But only after we've done this sorting can we turn to clear and hard thinking about educational goals, and what are our inflexible principles, and what, if anything, should be reformulated to meet our current students' needs. Okay, so then the question becomes, these are our students, how do we best educate them? Okay, in my opinion, an effective teacher is able to reach three aspects of the student. A good teacher reaches the intellect, and I still firmly believe that students won't appreciate a class unless they feel intellectually challenged and respected. Then there's the emotional component. Aside from those of you who will argue about how much you gain from that grumpy old 10th grade teacher who you hated every minute of sitting in their class, I think most people will still agree with the caveat, "Ein adam lomed el b'makom shelibo chafetz." Students need to feel engaged, and they need to feel a degree of joining and positive connection to their teacher, and they have to have a positive feeling about the experience of sitting in the classroom. Thirdly, need to connect on a personal level. They need to feel that they are hearing a message that is personally relevant or transformative in their own lives. To the degree that a teacher can balance all these things, they will be more successful, and to the degree to which an element is lacking, they will be less successful. Obviously, each teacher will vary their percentages and approach based on personal style and personality, and there needs to be a successful match with a specific population of student or specific individual students. But overall, at least I think in the Shana Aleph programs, for me, that's how I formulate my educational goals. Okay, therefore, it is our job as educators, both teachers and administrators, to formulate our educational goals to meet the needs of our students under this rubric. As a teacher, in the classroom, how do I balance heart, mind, and soul while maintaining fundamental educational principles? How do I strengthen skills and textual ability? And how do I foster critical thinking in the current educational climate? How do I engage without crossing the line into compromised behavior? I believe a helpful caveat here is keeping in mind the best interest of the students. It's not about my ego or my class size or creating mini-me's. It's about integrity and chinuch in its true sense, which I believe means helping my students grow into their best selves. This leads to the role of the administrators, who are charged with the task of creating an environment of imun, by which I mean educational integrity for their teachers to be able to succeed. A healthy educational environment creates a successful and appealing program based on core values and educational principles, is supportive of its teachers, recognizes the value of different styles and appeal, guides younger teachers, and encourages students to stick with the system. Okay, I'm aware that everything I have said is just the beginning of the conversation. Each point I have raised leaves room for explication, clarification, debate, and further streamlining. But to the degree to which we as educators engage with the issues and are willing to rethink and reevaluate, and to the degree to which we maintain our personal educational integrity, we will be able to maximize our ability to continue to successfully educate our students.
Rabbi Goldsmith.
Hello, everybody. Dr. Finkelman said that his employer is here this evening and he's treated very well. He wanted to make sure that he said that. My in-laws are here tonight and I am treated very well. I had to make sure that I put that out there. Of course, I'd like to begin with B'chvod Achsania. Thank you and Yisha Koach to Atid for taking the initiative to discuss and address these important issues. Thank you also to the other panelists. Evenings such as these remind us all how many talented people there are in one-year programs, all of whom, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, work together for the common purpose of educating the next generation of Yirei Shamayim and Torah Jews. Lastly, thank you also to the authors of the articles that we're discussing tonight. They have contributed greatly to that common purpose to which we all subscribe. Like most of us, I read the two articles on the Atid website that was posted on the Atid website with much interest. I most certainly agree that the one-year programs can always improve. I feel strongly that where I work, for example, the year we say that we have no problems and we have nothing to improve upon is the year that we need to close. I feel strongly that we all need outsiders and objective observers to assist us in that process of institutional introspection. As the Mishnah in Masechet Nagayim reminds us, Kol HaNagayim Adam Ro'eh Chutz Minigei Atzmo. No one person and no one yeshiva and no one seminary can do it alone. So these kinds of discussions, especially when they are conducted in a spirit of constructive critique, in spirit and substance, that is soter al manat livnot and not stam lekalkel, are indeed valuable and welcome. However, I must, with all due respect and sensitivity, express my disagreement with some of the components of the articles. First, while I agree with some of what was written, I cannot accept the arguments in the articles completely as a whole. I'm not entirely sure that it is true to say, as the brochure for tonight's discussion put it, that there is a declining educational atmosphere in yeshivot and seminaries. I would hope that the smaller working groups that are to be proposed tonight will discuss whether there is a declining educational atmosphere before helping to propose solutions to the problems we decry. I certainly think that the educational landscape here has changed over the years, and I also think, as mentioned, and Mrs. Brodsky mentioned also, that there's always room for improvement. But I think reports of the death of the one-year program in Israel are greatly exaggerated. Along those lines, I do not agree with the expression edutainment that was used in one of the articles. Frankly, I think it is gratuitous, sensational, and pejorative in a way that is insulting to the thousands of men and women who learn in Israel now and the tens of thousands who have learned here in the past. To speak in such broad and general terms about dozens of men's and women's schools, each program different in its own way, and each student in each program different in his or her own way, is inaccurate to say the very least. Moreover, the term edutainment and many of the issues raised in the articles speak negatively about the teachers themselves and minimize their abilities and commitment to excellence. Are the economic conditions perfect in the yeshivot and seminaries? Absolutely not. They are far from perfect, and everyone here knows that well. But to say that due to those less than ideal conditions, teachers necessarily teach poorly and contribute to a declining educational atmosphere is, in my opinion, patently false. The men's and women's programs that I'm familiar with seem to me to be filled with teachers who can and do teach in a challenging, professional, and effective way. There are teachers who, unlike what was stated in one of the articles, do not necessarily need to spend less time in the Beit Midrash or avoid having these students work through things on their own or refer to sources, as was mentioned in the article, in easy, digestible sound bites. And I think that the thrill of personal discovery gained through puzzling things out independently is alive and well in many of the fine institutions that we're speaking about tonight. Lastly, I think the term edutainment and some of the ideas discussed in the articles speak disparagingly about the crucial and undeniable need for affective and emotional components of any curriculum, in any program, of any age, in any country. If at least one of our goals is to inspire lifelong learners and observers of Torah, then those extracurricular activities play a crucial role in accomplishing that goal. Of course, this all has to be balanced, but I do not think that, as a rule, a school has to sacrifice everything in order to have those extracurricular activities. It wasn't these programs in Israel who invented the need for milta de b'dichuta, and it wasn't these programs who discovered the effectiveness and necessity for chanoch lanar al pi darko. I hope these words do not sound like I'm being defensive, self-protective, or naive. I am sure that some people may take my comments here tonight as such, but I still felt the need to tell the truth as I see it, despite the risks involved in saying it and being misunderstood. All I can say is that if I felt that the system were perfect, I wouldn't be here tonight. As I mentioned, there is still much work to be done. But I should say, in addition to the general desire for these programs to improve, and in addition to the improvements that need to be made due to the healthy and beneficial competition among the schools, other work is already being done that needs to be mentioned. It's important to note publicly the work that Yeshiva University is doing and has been doing for years. As a real partner to many of the schools, they have been working hard on two fronts that I know of. Number one, their umbrella organizations, YPAC and MIPAC, are wonderful forums for sharing ideas among and between institutions. They strike a great balance between that healthy competition and an even healthier sense of teamwork. Many of the initiatives and improvements over the years that these programs have benefited from have come as a direct result of these groups. Just one of the many examples, and I can only really speak about the women's side. The admissions process for 12th grade girls is infinitely easier and less intrusive to their learning due to the joint application, the agreed upon application deadlines, and the joint Israel nights in the New York area. All of these have helped the students tremendously and are a direct result of these meetings and discussions. Secondly, Yeshiva University has recently, I don't work for Yeshiva University. Secondly, Yeshiva, but it's important, I think it's important to note that things are being done. This is not the first time that yeshivas have been introspective and seminaries. Yeshiva University has recently established an assessment tool to help schools improve and progress. Under the guidance of Rabbi Dr. Hillel Davis and Dr. Scott Goldberg and others, the yeshivot and seminaries are engaging in a thorough, meticulous, and admittedly painstaking self-study process. That process, time-consuming as it is in my opinion, a very welcome addition and addresses many of the legitimate issues raised in the articles. Having said all that, there is, of course, still more work to be done. I don't have a lot of time left, but I did want to agree with and propose a solution for one of the major issues discussed in the articles, namely the PR piece, the recruiting, admissions, etc. It goes without saying that all of this is necessary to some degree, again, in any educational institution of any age, anywhere in the world. But everything is a balance, and all of us can work harder on that balance. For example, and this is just one example, perhaps if we were all able to agree upon fewer trips to Chutz La'aretz to meet with prospective students, everyone would benefit. Our current students would benefit by having us around more to teach, offer guidance, etc. And the 12th graders in Chutz La'aretz, to whom and for whom, presumably, we are traveling, would benefit by being able to be in class more and not at all of our presentations, interviews, etc. I spent a few years as the Israel guidance person in one of the high schools in America, and I know firsthand how disruptive these Israel schools visits can be. I'll say again that I think in many ways things have improved with YU's support and other in consolidating Israel Nights in the New York area, but there's always more to improve upon. And I am not improving, I'm not pointing a finger at anyone. I am as guilty as the next in this area. Of course, it's not easy. The author herself, himself, points out inadvertently the difficulties in making changes in the recruiting environment in these schools. She or he calls for more truth in advertising, with schools putting their cards on the table. Yet she or he wrote that anonymously. As mentioned in the article, of course, there should be truth in advertising. There should also not be, as the author says, infighting, bickering, lashon hara, of course. First of all, I'm saying it like I see it, I have not seen much of that at all. Does it go on? I bet that it does. But I must say, I honestly do not think it goes on as much as people say. Call me naive, but I can only tell you what I know and what I've seen, and I have not seen that much. Secondly, it's very hard, indeed impossible, to regulate menschlichkeit. If there is lashon hara that goes on, I think that the high schools and the students themselves are astute enough to send their son or daughter to a school where the representative can speak so disparagingly about another program. There is much more to say, but of course, ikar chaser min ha-sefer. All of us hope that tonight's discussion is only the beginning of more discussions that will undoubtedly be machloket l'shem shamayim along the way, with open, honest dialogue that will only benefit the wonderful young men and young women who come to Israel to learn and to grow. Thank you.
Rabbi Goldstein.
Good evening. First, I would like to thank Atif for the opportunity of speaking tonight and for their hosting this important forum. I also want to thank Yamin for coming and sharing his remarks. And I will say that I know of virtually no one in Chinuch who is more Yashar and Shem Shemayim than Yamin, and I hope that doesn't come off of my time. So, how do you do? Those your in-laws?
Yes.
Okay. I want to put my remarks in a context, and that is that I think that when we talk about the one-year program, the Year in Israel program, it's not something that we should see as a collective of individual schools, that someone's here from Shalavim or Midrash Ramid or here and there, but rather we now, the Mechanchim of 2010, Tavshin Ayin, are all part of a continuum, an institution called the one-year program. And I think that it has been very successful. If you just look around the room, you'll see the products of the one-year program. And so this is something that I don't take lightly to come and air grievances or emotionally, cathartically discharge what's bothering me. Quite the contrary. This is an important institution, and we, the Mechanchim of today, have been charged to bring it to the next generation. And as such, all institutions have golden ages and then ages of introspection. We have to take the opportunity to see, just to see, to introspect, and see how we can improve and what we can do to make sure that this important institution passes to the capable hands of our Talmidim. And so the introspection that I'll offer tonight is in absolutely no way an indictment of an institution, in particular an administrator, Rahman al-Itzlan. I think that things happen and people, institutions, countries for that matter, develop a rhythm and sort of get into a place where things are comfortable, and it's important for the people of those institutions at the various times to look in a mirror just to see if everything is okay and what can be improved. In the opening remarks, Yoel mentioned that there is a continuum, a natural cohesion between the two topics, and to a certain degree that that's true. But I would like to say that my topic tonight really starts after Molly, after what you said, which I think was very correct. It starts there, meaning every institution thinks about its strategy, thinks about its educational goals, thinks about what it wants to accomplish, who its projected talmidim are. That is nothing, and I think I wrote this in the article, it's been a while since I read it, that is something that is of every institution's concern, and not my concern, especially as an employee. An employee doesn't get the right to call the shots of what the educational vision of the school is, but once that educational vision has been put down in the mission statement, as a matter of record, then the institution has to begin to deal with the faculty, whoever the faculty may be. And that's where my story begins. And the truth is, I'll try not to get emotional. I will not get emotional. It's not even my story, the truth is. But it started to me as a very emotional one. And as time passed, I think I've calmed down just a bit and been able to put it into perspective, and that's what I'd like to share with you. Very briefly, my story is as follows. I teach in a school, and on the first day of school, I was called upon to present my class to the student body. And I present my class, and out of a student body of X, X minus 1 signed up for the other class. Get that? Wasn't a math class. So I have one student in my class, and the administrator calls me up and says, we have a little bit of a problem, what should we do? And discuss, and I ended up with a very nice mechubad class on another topic, the Seder. So I happened to be mentioning this story to a colleague of mine, and I said that this happened, and then we switched classes, and I have another class, and it's a very nice class, a different topic. And the person said to me, well, the same thing happened to me, but in my school, they told me that no one signed up for your class, so your class is being dropped, and you are out of a parnasa. And that bothered me to no end, deeply. It hurt me. And so I started to poke around a little bit. That's all. Just one, and believe me, I speak for no one but myself. It's not a scientific study. I started to poke around a little bit, and I found that there are similar stories in other places. So I called my friend, Yoel, and I said, we have to unionize. We have to form a union. So he said to me, calm down, Carl. Before you do that, maybe a more civil discussion can take place and issues can be worked out. Calm down. And I always value what Yoel has to say. So I did, and I wrote. And I'd just like to just raise three issues. And again, three issues that are present, I think, somewhat ubiquitous in faculty relations that exist, and I'd just like to put them out there, that's all. I think that the idea of paying a mechanic per class is something that should be reevaluated. Meaning, I taught in America for 10 years, in one school full-time, in one school very part-time, as part-time as it could possibly be. But I did receive a paycheck 12 months a year, and there were no surprises. And of course, this is not an issue of money. This is not a call for everyone who's in chinuch knows that the salaries are low. That's a given. That's not a problem. If it was a problem, it'd be in another profession. But I think that the idea of being paid per session has two issues. Number one, it creates a degree of distance, is my feeling, between the faculty and between the person, the teacher, and the school. As though to say, everything that you do is measured. If there's a, have to take your child to the doctor one day, that's your issue. If the machzom is crowded, that's your issue. And that develops a certain degree of distance, which will only come back when the faculty members ask to do extracurricular things, like host a student. There's no way to hide these things, I believe. So if a faculty member feels put upon, that's going to come out somewhere later in a not healthy way. And I also think there's a certain degree of peace of mind involved when a person knows exactly how much he's going to get paid, whether it's 10,000 shekel a month brutto, or whether it's 2 shekel a month brutto. To know that that's in the bank is something that, a peace of mind, that would help a mechanic tremendously. The second issue, and I only have three, is the idea that, as I mentioned before, no enrollment, no class is something that has to be revisited, because it sets a dynamic, and not to be sensationalist about it, but it sort of sets a dynamic of a Torah mall, as though the school is affording the opportunity to the teacher to have this time and space to give a class. And if you can have people come, people join, people come to your store, then you have a job. But if you don't, it's like retail. You don't. There's nothing we could do. The mall owner is not going to give you anything for trying. And I think that that's something which needs obviously to be, I'm not saying anything definitively, just to be revisited in terms of, is that a healthy dynamic in a faculty school, in the faculty school dynamic? Is that healthy? Or does that put a lot of pressure on the faculty member to get kids? Or does that, simply put, have someone who thought he had a job Purim time come Sukkot time and he doesn't have a job? And that's something important, and it's painful, but something we have to discuss. And the last thing, just to put on the table, is the issue of job security. I think that there is no job security to speak of, in that you are never really sure what you're going to get next year, even if you've done a good job this year. And that's something that I think needs to be revisited, and that is, I think, the most difficult question, because, well, I'm not here saying that it should be tenure and everybody should, because we know there are problems on every end. But I'm just saying the lack of stability, the fact that you don't know, as your kid's getting older, as you are getting older and becoming less interesting to the Talmidim of the present, what are we going to do with you and your pension and your life in the future when your kids get older? And of course, that could also be seen on the micro and the macro level. And on the micro level, no mechanic will be left behind. And everyone will be taken care of. But I do wonder about the future. About who's going to want to go in to a business which is not a business, but presents itself as though we have to sometimes be a fiddler on the roof, where there's not so much security, and you don't even know from month to month what you can count on. That's something that I think will be left to two types of people. People who have jobs in another sector, a lawyer who wants to give a shiur, a doctor wants to give a shiur, and that's wonderful, or somebody independently wealthy, which is certainly wonderful. But the professional mechanic, the person who has invested a lifelong goal of being mechanic the next generation, I'm just afraid that that will be something that's not tenable. That's not something that you can think of as an option when you are thinking about what to do. And so, I agree with what Yamin said. Certainly this is the beginning. This is a raising of the issues. Rachmana litzlan, chas v'shalom, this should not be taken as anything more than a situation that developed. And not anybody is to blame, and there shall be no, and there can be no pointing of the fingers. It's really just a holding up of the mirror. If this is something worth developing, worth talking about, then halavai we should continue. And just to be mechazek, the program, the institution is so important, and it really needs a strong class of people who feel comfortable that they can make a living with this. And this is something that they can devote their life to. And I think beyond the particular issues of this shekel and that shekel and this month and this Rebbe, on the macro level, it's something that we really, really have to address.
Rabbi Israel. Erev Tov, Morad Rabotai. First of all, again, I would like to echo people's comments and thanks to Atid for setting up this evening. I have always enjoyed Sichat Chaverim with fellow educators, and I think the process of discussing education enriches us all. So I want to say thank you very much to everybody involved. Everybody has begun with, I think, four speakers. It's difficult to give opening remarks, but we're all going to give our own assumptions to a certain degree. I'd like to start off by saying that I believe that in general, the one-year programs in Israel certainly those in the broader modern Orthodox bracket, are run responsibly, are run by well-meaning, principled administration. And I think they're doing, in many cases, a sterling job of really transforming generations of young people and giving them an attachment to Torah, which has changed the wider community. And we look at communities around the world and the number of Chavruta programs and the amount of learning that is going on, even religious standards within communities, you see the huge effects of the yeshivot and midrashot throughout communities around the world and in Israel. I'd also like to say that even though the articles have generated a tremendous amount of discussion, I sort of got into this position of sitting on this panel because I complained about the articles. I think this article suffered from a terrible overgeneralization. I was bothered by the anonymity. I thought they lacked real hard facts, and they were rather sensational. And I think we'd do well to follow the statement of Chazal, Chachamim Hizharu B'Divreichem, to be cautious of our words, especially Shivatayim, when they go to print. And I was concerned very much on the slur which might be placed on many of the good institutions and the good work they've done. I've been asked primarily to address pedagogic issues, and I'm going to try and say some things out of the box, but before that, please permit me 1 minute to talk about the economics. I feel that I have, when I read this, I remember my first comment to Yoel was, maybe I'm an exception, but I feel that my employers have been very responsible. Employers have always paid me on a pay scale of Misrad HaChinuch, pension, etc., etc. I've been assured by many other people who have received cash in envelopes and no payment over the summer and many other no sick days or whatever it might be, that is not the case. I think it's muvan me'ilav that we're not allowed to break any laws of Medina Israel. We've got to pay taxes, bituach lumi, by law now, pensions, vacations and the like. Likewise, with Torah institutions, not to keep certain halachot, to keep people waiting for pay. I don't really understand how we are educational institutions if we don't uphold certain very simple standards which are dinim midioraita. And therefore, I find it quite bizarre that these aren't kept in upstanding Torah institutions. Likewise, even certain things which might be lifnim mishurat hadin, the disturbing practice of certain places to fire somebody at the end of the year and to rehire them at the beginning of the year so they don't get tenure, etc., etc., smacks to me a little bit, smells a little bit too much of naval bereshut haTorah. I think employers have to show responsibility to their employees. And I certainly would like to suggest, at the very least, even maybe before the working committees begin, and you know how it works in the Knesset, if you've got a problem, you set up a committee, and who knows whether the problem will be solved, at the very least I think that Atid, or maybe the Joint Israel Program, should make it very clear and set up a list of workers' rights according to Israeli law that will be posted very clearly on their website, and that everybody can look it up. I would also like to suggest that maybe some form of unionization takes place. At the very least, not in order to batter employers into doing things and try and muscle in on them. I, after all, was born into Thatcherite Britain. But at least in order sometimes to be able to turn to a lawyer and get legal advice and know what your rights are. And if there was some sort of recourse to action, Misrad HaChinuch is a large system, and you sometimes do have those facilities. If we could have some way, even if it demanded a modest contribution, whereby we could take advice from some sort of employment lawyer when we had questions about whether our rights are being respected, I think that would be exceptionally useful. But I would like to move on to the question of, or the topic of, edutainment. And edutainment already has its own lilt and its own interpretation. In the article in question, we were talking about entertainment as opposed to education. And if I can quote, the year Israel has been transformed from a year of intensive Torah education
to a gap year of entertainment, diminished responsibilities, and personal release from some of the academic pressures of high school. Can we really generalize? I think we all know that there are many, many institutions which still uphold a strong commitment to intellectual learning, to intellectual rigor. I've conducted many, many interviews over the last 3 weeks. There is sometimes a feeling that people, the pay makorot, are getting thinner. That people are giving fewer makorot. That the Talmidim or Talmidot are able to stay in the Bet Midrash for shorter periods of time. And indeed, there seems to have been some sort of global ADD going on. I think some of us feel it very much, where, you know, Google is only a click away. And sometimes I feel that I have that same ADD, that in the middle of reading something, suddenly you're distracted by this and that, and Google is king, and our concentration spans has lowered. Maybe it's not just our students, maybe it is ourselves. Already in 2001, there was a Boston Globe article talking about how Harvard were dumbing down, and this is something that people have been speaking about for a long time. We are not immune from that, that is for sure. However, we should remember that there is far more learning going on than even a generation ago. A generation ago, whether it was Michlala or Michlelet or Rot or Machon Gold, they didn't have Seder Erev. Now most Midrashot have 3 Sederim a day. In other words, there is more text learning. I guess one of our questions is the question of quality. I'd also like to say that obviously huge growth in numbers, in the number of people who are coming to Israel, means there is a wide range of institutions. A huge range of institutions, ranging from those which admit students on a far higher intellectual standard to those who take students who aren't so stimulated intellectually. And of course that makes a big difference to throw the accusation of edutainment to everybody, I think is a little cool. But I would like to try and talk about edutainment in a different sense. Maybe I'll start off by reading a bit of a diary of one of my students. This is a student of mine, and I assume that what he wrote is pretty public since it was published on a blog in the Jerusalem Post. The blog was called Yeshiva Boy. So Yeshiva Boy wrote this sometime in February last year. Before I get kicked out of Yeshiva, let me explain. I agree wholeheartedly that time is all we have, and that wasting it is a tragedy. But I don't think that my distractions this year are necessarily a waste of time. And he writes in brackets, I don't think my rabbis would either. I've been training in Krav Maga multiple times a week. I've been writing a book. I've been meeting and schmoozing with amazing people, from late night talks to my friends in Yeshiva, to meeting Bibi Netanyahu the other night, to talking to random Israelis on the bus. And I've been seeing this beautiful country. And of course, I'm writing this blog, a pint-sized journal of my gap year abroad. Now, some people might call those activities distractions. After all, I'm in yeshiva, for crying out loud. Learn, learn, learn. What I've come to realize is that what some people call distractions from learning really constitute learning in the truest sense of the word. Because it is only against the backdrop of traveling the land of Israel that I can fully appreciate the laws regarding the land of Israel. And it is only against the backdrop of interacting with all sorts of people that I can appreciate the laws regarding being a decent human, treating all people with respect and the like. And it is only against the backdrop of being engaged in activities that one might not consider religious that I can appreciate imbuing even the mundane, the banal, with a sense of purpose and meaning. Is this edutainment or is this true education? There is a lady called Linda Kelly, and she is the head of the Australian Museum Audience Research Center, whatever that may be. And she wrote a fascinating paper, I think it was her PhD thesis, where she compared 3 words, entertainment, education, and a third word, learning. And it was fascinating. She asked people what their impressions were of these words. When you say education, what do you think? When you say entertainment, what do you think? When you say learning, what do you think? And people came out with very interesting responses. Education, structured. Entertainment, free-flowing, relaxing. Learning can be structured or unstructured. Okay. Here's an interesting one. Education.
teaching, entertainment, chosen, learning, chosen. Education, somebody is telling you. Entertainment, you're doing it. Learning, you're doing it. How do we make sure that our students are doing it? I think we all have a feeling. I mean, what are we really teaching for? For some of us, we do want to know another Masechet, and it's important that our students are well-versed. I know certainly for me, I gained the greatest sense of Sipuk in simply knowing more about whether it was Tanakh, whether it was about Gemara, but I assume that the people who are happy sitting in the Beis HaMedrash all day are not susceptible to the problems of edutainment. And therefore, by the way, ironically, if you Google edutainment and try and look it up, edutainment is a very positive thing. Edutainment is using other media in order to educate. What I would like to say is that I think if we say we have a problem and that our students are not on the level to sit in a Beis HaMedrash all day, we do have to think about the other experiences that we are giving them and to make them richer. How can we make sure that the Chana Ochel is more of an experience where they can grow in their Judaism? How can we make sure that the Chevrati experience within the Midrashah or the Yeshiva stresses the values of Ben Adam the Chaveiro? How can we make sure that when they go on Tehillim, it is not just a break from learning, but it is learning itself? How can we make sure that the time spent in the evenings enriches the environment? I know that many Israeli schools, high schools, whatever it might be, especially the girls' schools, invest a huge amount in terms of gibush, in terms of drawing the girls together. I think it's an ideal opportunity for Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. I think it's an ideal opportunity because, after all, at a certain point, our students are going to leave yeshiva and we're going to ask ourselves, what do they have? What do they leave with? And on this point, I'd like to move to my last point. Some years back, our friend Yoel Finkelman wrote an article in this volume, by Atid, called Virtual Volosion, Socialization versus Learning in Israel Yeshiva Program. And his contention was that in yeshiva and midrashah programs, there was things going on way beyond the Bet Midrash, way beyond the learning. Essentially, what he claimed was there was a certain socialization process going on where people, maybe even more influential than the Tosas they were learning or the Ramban they were learning, what was happening was they were undergoing a sort of personal transformation, but not on the basis of the limud that they were doing, rather from a sociological point of view. There was an identification, an increasing identification in the course of the year with the vocabulary, the cultural lifestyle of the yeshiva, with the image, if you want, with the brand of the yeshiva. And students must try to market the brand, to get into the brand, and that's how people were changing. You see, many of us talk about the primary thing in the year in Israel as being this great word, transformation. And for many places, they would much prefer to transform a person than to teach a person. Is that good? Or is that bad? If we transform a person on the basis of imitation, of branding, of socialization, okay, what happens when they move to their next institution, to university for 4 years? Do they take on that identity? Or is their true identity the yeshiva identity? How does it work? I recall so clearly when I was a young kollel guy, the sense that I really wanted all the students in Shana Aleph and Shana Bet to really have what I had. The commitment to Torah mitzvot, the inspiration, the connection to the Olam HaTorah, the persona of the Ben Torah, the dress of the yeshiva, I wanted to give them that. I wanted quite intensely to change them. And you know, when I think back on it, I think I wanted them to be me. And I say that because I think sometimes there's a big danger in this process of socialization that takes place in yeshiva. Because I remember one particular student, he was a chanich of mine previously in Bnei Akiva. A leading chanich, a leader of his shevet. And he came to yeshiva and I had a chavrus with him. And I was intent on giving him what I had, except a funny thing happened. He was very resistant. He didn't get into the learning. He wasn't interested. It didn't bother him. He was always a happy-go-lucky, jokey guy. Don't worry. He's from. He's a good balabas. He made aliyah. He lives in Ranana. He's got a great job. His family's from. But he wouldn't be a yeshiva bacha. He didn't want to do it. He was always joking around. And you know what? At a certain point, I found myself even getting angry. Even getting angry, why am I wasting my time with him? Why is he being so resistant? When you base yourself, the transformation, on the socialization process of the yeshiva or the midrashah, sometimes it works. Sometimes it's the easiest way. But sometimes it can be very dangerous. Because after all, what are the students left with after they leave? There is so much to do on the one-year programs. People expect too much. They expect to teach the students to learn, to love Israel, to become mentors, to learn to live by themselves, to grow up, and what have you. I have tried to stress the idea, not of edutainment, but rather of learning, and the idea that there are many other experiences which can complement the learning experience. But let me try and return to square one. After all, I guess the Misnagdish roots are run strong. The strongest experience, learning experience we can maybe give people, is real learning. There is nothing like giving students a project and having them really delve into that parasha and discover things themselves. After all, that learning is the discovery. When students really taste the taste of learning, be'iyun, delving into something, and whether it's chumash, whether it's gemara, that maybe is the most powerful transformation. Thank you.
Okay, first of all, thank you to the panelists, each of whom managed to tackle this issue from a different angle, and I think there is a lot of food for thought, and I've got a lot of things jumbling around in my head. The one thing that I do want to mention is that Rav Alex's point regarding producing a document that describes proper practices, best practices, is something that is on our agenda, and again, I encourage people who are interested in being involved in that to please sign up with Emunah for the working group. Again, I want to encourage people, if you have questions, to write them down clearly and pass them up to Rabbi Sachs. The first question, regarding the Yeshiva Boy blog. Has the student made a connection to Limud Torah and Shmirat HaMitzvot? Has he taken steps to support and encourage a lifelong connection to observance of Judaism? Has he done it here in Israel, and will he continue to do so when he leaves Israel? Sounds like you wanted to emphasize the positive aspects, and the questioner wants to know whether that's built on top of the Limud Torah or whether that's in place of it.
Okay, I mean, since you can probably find that identity relatively easily just by Googling the blog, I should be careful what I reveal. I think, can people hear?
Yes.
Okay. I should be careful what I reveal. I will simply say that a guy who was educated in he is religious. He is was educated in a modern Orthodox school. He is currently not at YU. He is in an Ivy League college. And facing significant challenges because of the environment that he has gone to. He certainly was in yeshiva, not somebody who was considered to be messing around. He came to shir, he took part. He was just emphasizing the idea of certain supplementary things that he experienced in his year. I have to say that as an educator, and as the years go by, I feel this sometimes more, I always wonder, what do my students have outside the classroom? I meet them over a chumash, I meet them over a daf gemara. Okay, who's musically talented? Who's a leader? Who's a follower? Sometimes you think you see it in the class, but do you really know? And because a lot of my formative educational experience were in youth groups, where you saw much, you knew who could dance and sing, you knew who was the joker, you knew who was this. Sometimes I feel that in the classroom, I'm only educating a sliver of the person. What about the whole person? They spend more time out of our classes during their year than they spend in our classes. What happens to all that time? Or I'll say even slightly differently. If we educate them to be yeshiva bachrin, if we educate them to be midrashah girls, again,
5 years down the line, some of them will be, but most of them probably will not still see themselves in that persona. And therefore, we have to think carefully, what are we giving? What are the tools that we're giving that are going to remain? Now, of course, again, we can all think about our own biography, and we can all think ourselves, and what do we remember of it? And talk to friends. But it's something that constantly, as an educator, I don't have answers. It's something that constantly gives me food for thought. Right, it's true. We're all the people who fell in love with learning, decided to learn a lot more, and that became our life. And what about everybody else? What part does this role programs, what part does this year or two play in their long-term life?
Okay, I want to read one comment that's not a question. And needs to be said to a degree, et chata'ai lochim askirayom. Tomer Ryan says, the ad in the Torah tidbits that invited the general public used the word provocative sensationalism rather than thought-provoking serious discussion. But more importantly, there was a public condemnation, not as a question, but as a statement, declining educational standards, etc. For all of us who view ourselves as being involved in Avodat HaKodesh, it was disconcerting. Particularly regarding the fact that three of the four panelists don't seem to find a lack of professionalism or declining, changing, yes, but not necessarily declining atmosphere. So I think that that needs to be said.
Use the microphone.
Okay. Daniel Wolf has asked whether any of the panelists can describe in what way an institution has been involved with contributing to their professional developments as educators. And if I can even add a step further, is there an institutionalized culture of professional development within the one-year programs?
So I can just say that I have been involved in numerous institutions. The institution at which I spend most of my time, I find to be, has been consistently helpful in terms of my own personal professional development, as well as extremely supportive in my experience of young teachers who are coming into the system. I have not had experience, I've not seen that type of thing where I'm like, okay, you only have one student. They will run classes for two students, three students, and then work, as far as I know, work with teachers to help them maximize their ability to teach. I think that, again, personally, I've found very open administration, a lot of dialogue about how to, again, maximize the educational experience, open doors, meetings. I think that's all I'm going to say.
One area which I think is very, very fruitful is even teacher meetings, which is a constant dibuk haverim and discussion. I'm being careful not to name institutions because but at least two of the institutions that I have been involved with, am involved with, have regular professional enrichment for their staff, and I think it should be spread wider. When you hear different ideas, whatever they are, that's quite incredible. But I think it is rare.
Okay, I'm going to read a couple of questions and then open it to anybody who wants to. First, when the primary element of curriculum structure is electives, where's the place for us to be able to lead students, guide students to the important skills and the important knowledge? Question number one. How can we talk about goals without quantifiable standards and measures? Between schools and often within them, measures of success vary greatly. In my experience, this leads to confusion among students, parents, alumni, and teachers regarding the question of are we being successful if that is not being measured. And third, take three questions at a time so you can pick and choose. How can the one-year
Anglo land in Israel and give our students contact with positive Israeli students of the same age and compatible outlook. You can even, I think, expand that question even further and say, what about Israel beyond 18 and 19-year-olds as well?
Anybody want to tackle one or all?
First of all, I think in terms of Anglo land, where I'm very comfortable, much more comfortable, that's something that I think that every institution really needs to think about where it fits in. There are going to be, there's a cross-spectrum of students. Obviously, not everybody can have the same program, and I think the kids gravitate towards where there's more integration or towards where there's less integration. So I think the core issues of that study of the program, there is a place for all different types of schools. The problem is they go, could you just come up with the second question?
Quantitative measures? Quantitative measures. How do we measure?
It was choice that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah,
that's it. No, the truth is, that's something that I really think also needs to be addressed. I guess I agree with the question that there is certainly a place for choice. There has to be. I know when you're a high school, regular high school kid, can't wait for college because they want to take ancient Greek poetry. They can, and it's a choice. It's very exciting. It's a very essential part of education. We have guests from the more sorry yeshivas. We tend to say there's much less choice. And I guess that's sort of a modern orthodox thing. Maybe not. But I think that there has to be some guidance, and the curriculum is set up completely based on choice. It's not good for the student. I don't think it's good for the teachers. For the teachers either.
Also talk about the choice question, I guess. It's true, it's up to the schools and the administrations of those institutions to give choice. Well, as we do with our children and we do with anybody else that that is under our care, we make sure we give them choices, but choices within within a set guideline that we think is appropriate for the students. This question of quantitative measures is a question that needs to be asked in every educational institution from Trom Chova to law school and everything in between. And I think that we as an institution, as Rabbi Goldstein said, I think as an institution, we need to think of general goals, and then as independent institutions, we need to come up with our own goals and our own measures of success. I think, and I'm not an expert in every school in Israel, of course, but the school that I interact with, I think that does happen. I think that does occur. Like human nature, entropy does occur, and sometimes we find ourselves a year or two or three or four going without reevaluating these measurable quantitative measures. However, I'm pretty sure that schools do get a chance and do because of either their own guided value as educators, and two, because of the competition that's so healthy, I think we do actually do that. The fact that it may not necessarily come out in the brochure, the website, or the presentations is a different discussion, but I think it does occur.
I'd just like to say that as regards Israel experience, one of my other hats that I wear is running seminars for Nefesh for Nefesh throughout all the different yeshivot and midrashot. It's actually interesting because I get a chance to see a cross-section. I run a similar program for almost every institution. But I can certainly say that I think that the engagement with both Israelis, with Israeli society in general, from many of these students, and from hearing them talk, the people, the Israelis that I've met, are taxi drivers and bus drivers. And that's it. The others are all English speakers. I think it's a tremendous cover. I'd say even more than that, I think that for many of the students, their knowledge of current issues in Israel and their engagement with some of the tensions that are taking place there is so microscopic and it's so simplistic. And I think there are many, many opportunities. By the way, if this is unlikely to come from the majority of the students. But I think this is exactly one of the areas in which programs should be trying to whet the appetite and to arouse the curiosity of the students to expand their horizons.
I want to ask the TEATS board member, Dr. Beverly Griffiths, for a has a question.
Yeah, Beverly came right down with something in this hour of meeting, so I'm sure I'll speak about that. First of all, I just want to give a common attraction for Dr. Bernstein. I don't know if you'll speak about this evening or you'll speak about this in a smaller group, but on the issues of the economics and the professionalism, don't start from FS. I was privileged to serve on the board of Pardes, where over many years and many meetings, we worked out a system for basically what is a one-year program to deal with all of these issues of the teachers, including what happens if there's only one student, and when do you know, and how could there be not skewed and yet skewed. And there is a model for this, so you don't have to, you know, you can take it from there. Okay, and now I want to say what Alex began to say. And I don't usually take with my own students the attitude of you people. Okay, but you people sound, I don't even understand what Torah Eretz Yisrael is. I'm the generation that didn't go to Israel, right? It was not. When I graduated from day school, you were supposed to go straight to college, and you did not go to Israel. It was 5 years after me. But it sounds like we're talking here about some finishing school programs that are supposed to, at best, seal in your knowledge and skills, and perhaps on a high level, a little bit of it, or seal in your observance and your front cover. But where is Israel in all of this? So Alex began to say it now, and the blogger said it. But if there is a need to upgrade or to change the programs now because there's a new generation of children or of young people coming, I would say use Israel as the text. There is a tremendous amount that can be done here in Israel in a very engaging way, even if it has to be in English, and I will not speak, there are many people here in this room who've heard me on the subject of Hebrew and where it is in the day school, and that this evening has to be run in English. But for all adults, okay, it could be in English to engage not only with young people the same age as the kids you have, some of whom are facing tremendous dilemmas about the army and their boys and girls. There are huge issues going on that Israeli kids want to talk about. There are forums that you could be arranging, and it would be very easy to get Israelis involved in them. There are midrashot and nechinot and yeshivot for the same age in Israel that are doing all kinds of interesting things. Yes, there are certain cultural barriers that have to be jumped over, but that can be done. And all of the issues of what it means to have our own state starting from the text. I mean, I don't have to elaborate, but I didn't hear it. I haven't heard it yet. And it seems to me that if the programs are suffering, that this would be a direction in which to go. And I will say that I first thought that these were two separate issues. But I now see that really they are this one issue of still bringing an American culture into this one-year program business. I think, and I'm going to try to be careful what I'm saying, there is a glut of people who want to teach in these institutions because a lot of people who were teachers in elementary schools and high schools, Jewish schools in the United States, want to make Aliyah and want to come to Jerusalem. And because of the language and the cultural gap, you people can't get into the Israeli system, so therefore you all need or want to be teaching in these post-high school programs. I would say that people somewhere, and it's, you know, maybe too late for the older people, but if people want to make Aliyah, they have to start thinking when they're younger about preparing themselves for working in the Israeli system. We won't go into all the difficulties of that, but going to the Galil, going to Eilat, going to other places and doing other things in Israel, and then maybe there won't be a glut of teachers in the one-year program, or maybe more and more people will come to one-year programs and you'll meet everybody. That's a small fraction. That's what I have to say.
I just wanted to respond to Dr. Gervitz, and that was the point I forgot to make, and I agree with you. And someone I heard reaction to my article anonymously up until recently. That was one area of misunderstanding that I think came out. The yeshivos should not be like the Social Security Service was 60 years ago. That's what people, if they're Jews, want to get a job. They should not be. There should be, I guess this will end the union idea, there should be fewer positions. They should be, the class of educator should be enhanced, and I think the glut, right now, and again, this is my contention that we're sort of like on autopilot in this, I think the glut feeds into the machine as it is right now, and that's what I think that we should be taking stock of. But I will say this, I think that people will figure out what to do if they have to. When it ceases to be an option, people are already getting wise to it. You know, I can't come and expect that they'll be working the seminaries. The problem, I hope, is that not everybody does that. That can be maintained. Because it is important to have an educated class for this population. But for everybody else that wants to make Aliyah, I think that I disagree with that last point. People will figure out what to do. They will. If they want to make Aliyah, we have somewhat of a workable Hebrew, and I guess we would figure out. I think people will. Just now, it's sort of stuck in this system that people are overpopulating. But, you know, that's not much of a fault. That's just the mitziyut right now, the reality. And that's what we have to start to work out, I think.
I also should call out to Dr. Gribbins for sharing that. My initial response after you spoke I did clap, but my initial response was to agree wholeheartedly. And I'll say that my Zionist credentials are well documented. And I personally, in a school that I work in, and I think many of my colleagues in other institutions, would fully agree with you. However, I believe that is step two. We're talking here about, we're beginning an evening where hopefully smaller working groups are going to be formed. We're not just pontificating, to try to do things. And I think while I may agree that is a goal, I don't know if it's the goal of every institution. And rather than say that should be the goal, I think the discussion should be, what are the goals? If an institutional goal is integrated into the Israeli society, know what's going on at a sophisticated level in the Knesset and elsewhere, if that is a goal, then I would agree with you. And I do personally, as Hassan was getting also, I certainly think that where I work, and we have certainly more Israeli youth. However, that's what I personally think. I'm not sure it's true for every institution. I think before we say it should be a goal for everyone, I think everyone should think about what their goals are, and if it's a goal, work towards that goal.
Okay, I'm going to do something not fair, because I see that the clock is ticking. And there are a bunch of good questions that I'd love to raise and love to hear discussion of, but I think the hour is getting late, so I'm just going to mention some of the topics that have come up in questions that have not been addressed that I think are important. There's another question about integration with Israelis. There's another question that's related to this follow-up question about people who are coming, expectations of full-time work. The phenomenon of people who are working multiple jobs and are working 2 hours here, 5 hours there, and 6 hours there, which creates problems of attachments to institutions and creates problems for the educators themselves, and has a financial price to pay, has a educational price to pay, has an emotional price to pay, has a shalom bayit price to pay. I'm elaborating on the question. That's a topic that needs, I think, to be addressed. Another question.
Let me add the counter side of that is
our schools. And again, whenever we talk about any particular practice, Latovol or not, we're talking only about certain institutions. Schools that see as an ideal having a stable of part-time faculty. Institutions that are almost completely staffed by an array of part-time people. Sometimes this passes under the headline of, well, we want to expose our students to as many people as possible. In reality, there's also likely some kind of financial motive here to keep down salaries and etc. And that's, I think, another example where you see the interaction of financial decisions and which can't be divorced from educational outcomes.
Two other questions that came up again that I'm just going to mention, and I'm going to pass the microphone to Dr. Bernstein. What are the responsibilities of teachers? To what extent should one year programs be charged with guiding and mentoring new teachers? Which is kind of a standard practice in elementary schools and four-year high schools. And to what extent is that a responsibility? And I would add also something that could pay for itself, if not in dollars and cents or shekels on the road, certainly educationally, it might. And one more issue, which is a question of coordination and cooperation between the programs. To what extent could some of these issues be addressed more effectively if, in addition to the good work that the university is doing, that Rabbi Goldsmith mentioned, to what extent could more coordination between institutions help streamline all kinds of practices, not only the recruiting issue that you mentioned, but also all kinds of other administrative issues? Could more coordination work in that direction? I wish we had time for more reactions to that, but I want to pass the microphone on to Dr. Bernstein for summary remarks.
Okay, so first of all, there are very big shoes to fill. Lorraine over our name, Rabbi Gravender, I am sure that I will not be as insightful as he would have been. I know I will not be as funny as he would have been. And I know I will probably not be as sarcastic as he would have been. On the one hand, there's, what else is there to say? So much has been said. On the other hand, we all know that if we broke up now into small groups of people at the patients, everybody could go on and on and talk for hours about some of the issues raised here. So I was wondering, I had a certain idea of what to say, and then I realized that maybe the first thing I ought to do is very, very briefly, in a few bullets, summarize. In other words, just repeat again some of the points that were made that I thought were worth repeating. Molly Brodsky said, these are the students we have, how do we best educate them? And talked about heart, mind, and soul. Rabbi Goldsmith talked about the problem of generalizing negatively about students of this generation and about the schools, and talked about the many good schools and raised the initiatives that YU is sponsoring with the women's schools working together. Rabbi Goldstein talked about the importance of looking in the mirror and talked about how teachers' jobs often depend on student interest and used the phrase Torah Mall and the lack of job security. And Rabbi Alex Israel talked about the overgeneralization and sensational nature of the articles, the original articles. He also talked about global ADD and also pointed out that there's more learning in many schools than there was years ago. And then talked about how not everyone will be a Talmid Chacham. So, What do I have to add to that? I'll just, in a couple of minutes, say that my own involvement in Israel programs began in the old country, which for me means the United States, where I was the first Israel guidance counselor for Hamas, sometime around 1980. At that time, I think there may have and may not have been even one or two other schools that had such a position of an Israel guidance counselor. In 1980, the major work was to try to get students to be interested in going to Israel. And then the harder job was then to convince the parents that it was okay if their children went to Israel. And this was at a time when not only Barney and Stern, but Columbia and Barnard and Penn all gave a full year of credit. Is anybody coming to Israel with parents? I remember one parent who threatened she would literally jump off the roof if her son, God forbid, would go to Israel. Of course, today we know it's very, very different. Today, I think, for many parents in Orthodox schools, if their child will not go to Yeshiva in Israel, they'll jump off the roof. Things have changed very much. When Rabbi Gravinder founded Michal and Buria in 1976, and then opened up a program for 18-year-olds in 1985, it was only the fourth school for women that could appeal to the group of people here, of the modern Orthodox Yeshiva High School graduates coming at that time. There was Mahon Gold, Olam HaShalom, there was Michlala, and there was Benot Torah Shofins. Oros, thank you very much. This was the fifth. That was it. There were no other schools at the time. And of course, Liz Kutol, the Shikoshel, Rabbi Gravinder, this was the first women's institution, not only to teach Talmud, but to have a Beit Midrash. In 1985, 1976, and then in 1985 as well, there was no other women's institution that even had a Beit Midrash. The large numbers of students who are coming today and the proliferation of schools is sort of beyond anybody's imagination. For those of us who were on the other end in 1980 trying to get students, trying to create this institution, a year in Israel was taught learning, it was a dream that it would become the norm and that most people would come and there would be so many choices for students. But success has its problems. They might be good problems, but success has its problems. It used to be that when you had to fight your parents and fight the system in order to come to Israel, of course, only the most motivated came. And today, when it's the thing to do, so everybody comes without thinking very much. And I question whether, in the history of the Jewish people, we had such a high percentage of people at the age of 18 studying Torah full-time. Or whether that's actually quite abnormal in the history of the Jewish people, because most Jews got a very elementary education, and only the Iluyim were able really to move on to some kind of higher education by the ripe old age of 18. And so what we've created is, on the one hand, something unprecedented, something that demands a great diversity of institutions that will cater to many different kinds of people. As Rabbi Alex Israel said, not everybody is going to be a Talmid Chacham. And this, of course, comes at the same time as the global ADD that Rabbi Alex Israel mentioned, and as Dr. Griffiths mentioned, the decline in Hebrew language skills. It doesn't begin here. There is something about the teaching of Hebrew language that is different today than it was a number of decades ago. I don't want to enter into what the issues are, probably many factors. And that, of course, has implications for how easy it is, how approachable a text is for a student if they're learning it in Hebrew. Because many of them are coming not only with global ADD, but with Hebrew language skills that don't equip them to do the same work that the people in this room, or at least some of the people in this room, were able to do 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. Having said all this, I want to say that it's really, it's a wonderful blessing for the Jewish people. It's a tremendous opportunity for the Jewish people. I'm reminded of the growth of the Jewish day schools in the 1960s and 1970s that took place largely not for Shem Shemayim, but because the public schools in America started to decline. And many Jewish parents who were happy to send their children to Bronx Science decided instead to send them to a yeshiva high school because public schools were dangerous or their educational standards had slipped. And that created a tremendous opportunity, which I thought the Jewish day school movement took advantage of. We're faced, I think, with a similar situation in the last decade or two here with the growth of Israel programs. There's a great number of people coming. Not all of them are necessarily coming l'shem shamayim, whatever you think shem shamayim is. It can be many different things, I would argue. But it's a great opportunity that we have, and clearly, having very diverse institutions with diverse goals, dealing with diverse populations, is only better and not worse. I have many other things I could say about Israel peace, about the glut of teachers. Just yesterday, I had the heartbreaking experience of counseling a young person who thought that what she really wanted to do was come to Israel, make Aliyah, and work in Jewish education here, and has sort of found out that it's not probably going to be so easy as she thought. And that she's thinking that, you know what, maybe it's better to be a Jewish educator in North America. Knowing what the job situation is here, and the kinds of places she might want to be, she had reason to doubt whether she could really make a career. Maybe that's not a bad thing. Maybe that's just a reality. To me, it's a little bit sad. But the efforts that have been made by some to try to have distance learning, to take advantage of the fact that we have here, between Jerusalem and Gush Etzion alone, the largest group of talented mechanchim anywhere in the world, who can't find jobs, and we all know that so many of them who are even not the best, but even just good, solid teachers, how they would be snapped up in so many communities all over the Jewish world. Finding a solution to that may be beyond the purview of the committee that will work here, but I want to thank all of the panelists because it made me think, and the team, and I hope people will look forward to being involved in some of this committee work to try to improve what is already a terrific